So this is about John Lennon. In 1968, he decided that he had to confront what was happening politically because as a Beatle, he had been told to keep his mouth shut for a couple of years. Brian did not think it was a good idea for John to talk about the war in Vietnam or politics. Finally, John started to do it, and then he began to shake things up. He had made the comment that the Beatles were more popular than Jesus, and that was a complaint. That wasn't like pride or mocking the religion or anything like that. It annoyed him that the Beatles were treated with such specialty. He thought it was hypocritical. As he said in his famous Rolling Stone interview, there are photos of him coming out of bordellos at dawn, drunk on his ass, with prostitutes everywhere. When 1968 began, the Beatles had been through the ringer. In 67, they'd had this fantastic success of the Sgt. Pepper album. It changed the world. Very few albums have had an effect on the culture like Sgt. Pepper did. I was alive then. I remember that week when Sgt. Pepper came out. And there was never anything else like that in my life. Everywhere you turned was Sgt. Pepper. It didn't last very long. It was maybe a blip in time. It was like in unison, the world was there. Now, of course, there were millions and billions that didn't listen to it too. But it sure seemed to hit something deep in our culture. The end of 67, though, you know, Brian Epstein had died, accidental overdose in August. They had been introduced to the Maharishi, and John was so much in seeking an answer. That's what he wanted, was an answer. Why was he so successful? He knew because he was an artist, but what did that mean? Why was it happening the way it was? And the thing they did after Brian died, the Magical Mystery Tour, was the first bomb in their careers. It was the first time people called it absolute rubbish. They said it was absolutely horrible. And he'd never experienced that at such depth before. And as 1968 began, everything was just very strange for John. Now, remember, John had turned on to LSD in 1965, and he became a regular user. In the Rolling Stone interview, he said he had had 1,000 trips. I sort of think he's probably exaggerating, but he had a lot of trips. He had a doctor's mortar bowl with LSD in it in his room, and he would just wet his finger and run it in the bowl and put it on his tongue and take off on another trip. And he did it all the time through 1966 and 1967. But as 1967 was coming to an end, after 2 years of it, he still hadn't found the answer. And now they were getting booed. And as 1968 began, there was even a hit song in the States that was a parody of one of John's songs, which made him, you know, weird. That freaked him out a little bit. What I'm talking about is Judy in Disguise with Glasses, you know, by John Fred. Just a joke song, but it kind of spooked him because he was the object of things like that. Let's take a look at where John's head was at this time. This is a tape from his home tapes. It's called Stranger in My Arms. Just listening to this will make you feel high.
Standing there without a only hope I can. You're a stranger in my arms. You're a stranger in my arms. Whenever I see you, you're a stranger in my arms.
That was a personal tape of John's. So many have escaped into the universe. Stranger in My Arms, that dates from December 67, January 68. At this point, he and Cynthia, he always tried his best to be the good husband for Cynthia, but he was bored totally with the actions of it, and he felt terribly guilty during this time, too. However, he'd met Yoko Ono in 1966, and she had been in the distance during 67. He had actually paid for one of her art shows, or maybe more than one. He certainly had a business and artistic relationship with her from the beginning. Cynthia knew of Yoko, but as of end of 67, early 68, Yoko was stalking John Lennon. She was sending postcards every day, or 5 or 10 postcards every day. She would just show up, just stand around outside his door. This was an actual act of stalking, and he reciprocated. She was interesting, whereas she wasn't just another journalist that was around him or these hot little girls that they'd run into out in the social scene. Here was somebody who was interesting, very different, and serious in her own way. Yoko's very first appearance at a Beatles recording session was in February 1968, and she was there when he recorded Across the Universe and Lady Madonna and Hey Bulldog. So here from the February 4th, 1968 recording session at EMI is the alternate take of Across the Universe, a song that John put special stock in, thought it was his greatest song ever. He dreamed up this song and then had to rush in the studio and record it.
You're right, Richie.
Words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. They slither wildly as they slip away across the universe. Pools of sorrow, waves of joy are drifting through my opened mind, possessing and caressing me. Chakuru Deva,
I find that ominous. Nothing's going to change my world. Like he was challenging the world. First version of Across the Universe. John gave the song to the World Wildlife Federation, and that's how it first appeared as a charity album to raise money for wildlife. But he always complained that this greatest song of his was never given any serious treatment. The girls that were singing along with him there were just groupies out in the street that Paul went out and asked to come in and sing. Nothing special was done for his great song, and John resented that. He was starting to get a paranoid frame of mind. He was still doing a lot of drugs, though that was about to stop because they did the trip to Rishikesh in India to visit the Maharishi. John wanted to take both Yoko and Cynthia, but he couldn't figure out a way to do it. And so he took Cynthia, and the two of them had had a really nice place that had air conditioning. I mean, they had it much better than even some of the other celebrities who were there at the ashram. But they were there for the month of March, and they wrote a lot of songs, and John did not do drugs. There were no drugs there to be done. And so they all experienced a cleaning out period, and John was writing lots of songs. George even complained and said, "We came here to meditate, not to write songs." But even George was writing songs. Yoko continued to stalk John even from a distance because she continued to send 10, 20 postcards a day. So there'd be all this mail that would come in every day, and John got to the point where he would try to sneak out, get away from Cynthia, and go see what was in the mail. Again, that he was starting to feel guilty about what they were doing. And in the meantime, all the beginning startup of Apple was going on. So when John got fed up at the Maharishi and blamed him, wrote to Sexy Sadie, you know, Maharishi, what have you done? You made a fool of everyone. Both Cynthia and Alex Mardis, who was John's friend who came along, felt that John was just kind of not fair to the Maharishi, that he wasn't trying to do anything. He was just enjoying the celebrities being around and the attention that he was getting. But he was an old man, and he'd been doing this, and his heart was in the right place. It was just what was happening. But John got all fed up and furious with the Maharishi because the Maharishi didn't give him the answer. And he wanted the answer. That's what he wanted. Ringo left first after like 3 weeks. Paul went shortly afterwards. And then John left and George left shortly after that. Famously, on the trip back, he broke down to Cynthia and confessed about all of the affairs that he'd had in their marriage. And he apologized and said, I want more children with you. I want our life to come together. And Cynthia just couldn't believe it. She actually couldn't believe how begging he was. And she even said to him, are you sure you don't mean you're better with Yoko? And he said, she's a joke. I want to be with you. When John got back from India, he started gobbling down acid again. He and Paul got it together back in London, and they came to the United States to announce the opening of Apple. And so they appeared in New York City. They were on The Tonight Show. And they come back, and in late April, they went to George Harrison's house, Kinfons, in Esher. And they recorded demos of the songs that they had written in India. And so the song that we're concerned with tonight, long introduction, finally makes its appearance. John had been thinking so much about what to say about politics in song. And so he wrote this song, and here's the Escher demo of Revolution.
Wait for it.
Yeah.
talk about destruction. Don't you know that you can count me out? Don't you know it's gonna be
the Escher demo of Revolution from April 1968. So that's another snapshot of John's mind right at this moment. He had commenced right back into serious acid. He was still looking for the answer. He was going to his mortar and pestle every night, and he was smearing his tongue. And he did the strangest thing. The other Beatles never really talked about it. But on May 18th, about a week and a half before they were going to begin recording the new album, John called a board meeting of Apple. So George and Paul and Ringo and George Martin and the mainstay people who were there all showed up and sat around the table. And John very seriously got up and announced that he had discovered that he was Jesus Christ, come back again. And he didn't really know what to do about it, but we needed to announce that John Lennon had come to the realization that he was Jesus Christ. And so Paul and George says, well, we probably shouldn't let the news out about this, so let's keep it quiet. And John agreed it was too important of information to let out. And so obviously John's mental state was strange, let's say. Pete Shotton, who was John's lifelong friend from the old neighborhood, he was there. He was one of the people at the board meeting. And he said afterwards he went out to dinner with John. He was asked by the waiter how he was doing this evening. And John said, I'm fine. I'm Jesus Christ now. And the waiter said, well, that's fine. Your last album was really terrific. And John laughed when he heard that. That night, May 19th, 1968, at around 1 or 2 a.m., Pete and John were sitting around with their minds all altered from the mortar and pestle, and John decided to call Yoko Ono. And they called Yoko, and a taxi came and brought Yoko over, and John and Yoko came in together. He gave her some acid, and they went up to his studio, and they recorded the Two Virgins album over the next 3 hours or so. In other words, they did experimental tapes with each other. And basically, John found the answer to what he was looking for. It still was going to make him guilty, But from that moment, for the next, until 1973, he was no longer John. He was John and Yoko. June 4th, 1968. At EMI Studio. On June 3rd, they had worked all day on John's song, Revolution. And they had laid down several parts, and John liked the overlap feel of what they were doing. So he was keeping the mic open for everything at this time. So they recorded Revolution, the version that's on the White Album called Revolution 1 now. And it went on for 10 minutes, and the last 4 minutes or so he shaved off and used as a rhythmic bass so that he and George Harrison and Mal Evans and Yoko constructed what became Revolution 9 from that last 4 minutes. And so they had the first version of it, and John really thought the song was important. But Paul said, well, but we can't release it as a single. It's too slow. And so John decided to come back and bring the song back again. And they did the single version. The basic tracks for the single were recorded on July 10th, 1968, with overdubs in August. And the single was released in September. You know, I always think about the two songs that came at the same time. The Rolling Stone Street Fighting Man appeared on the charts on September 7th, 1968 in the UK, and Revolution appeared on the 14th, the next week. They are similarly confronting the ideas, though, whereas Lennon is saying, you say you want a revolution, we all want to change the world. Jagger is saying, time is right for a palace revolution, but where I live, the game is compromise solution. What can a poor boy do but to sing in a rock and roll band? Because in sleepy London town, there ain't no place for a street fighting man. And that's the same message in its own way. And then in the 90s, a tape that had been lost for ages appeared that gave us our first glimpse into what revolution was. I'm now going to play for you a tape that is Yoko Ono sitting upstairs above the main floor of the studio. And there's a speaker piped into the room that she's in, is the music that they're working on downstairs. And she has a tape recorder, and she is making notes for herself. Of course, the people who hate Yoko just call this endless ad nauseum psychobabble. But she talks about how Andy Warhol just got shot. She talks about moving to, you know, into a new place. Even she wasn't sure about John right then, but John constantly pops up again. Now, this is just an excerpt of the tape. I actually have the full-length tape, which is over an hour long, though the excerpt that I'm going to play here has all of the essential music. Because what we care about is what's going on in the background. Because here, you get to hear them doing overdubs and working on different parts of the song Revolution. And I know this is, don't worry, it's going to clear up. This isn't the only way we're going to hear this. But I think it's worth listening because it's different than any way you expect it. So here is Yoko Ono and the Beatles.
On all my nerves. And then he said, well, that's like a fairy story. And
Revolution takes 20.
And I get paranoid. And yet, it's there. It's always there. I suppose there are some people who really like that. Maybe once every century or something. That when a meeting is really, really good, probably that happens. Maybe once every 2 centuries or something. Or probably who have that kind of relationship never bother to tell it to others, and nobody really believes it, so that we don't know about it. But it's amazing that it does exist. And it's amazing that the only time that I remember about my promiscuity is when I feel so insecure that I feel intentionally that I have to bring that out in me to sort of protect myself. But other than that, it never is there. Feel that I have to hold back because I'm not quite sure if you feel that way. Well, that's like a kind of strange calculation, maybe. You know, that's the kind of calculation bit that. The cleverness bit, you know, like holding back because you don't know that other person's feelings are. But one has to protect oneself in a way. Or should one?
Telephone call to Italy.
No. To Italy? So now John tells me the same. If I had booked a telephone call to Italy, which I did, so I should have. Bill said that he got a very nice place for me, and he's found a very nice place for me. It's overlooking the park, the High Park. It's quiet. It's on the third floor. Both rooms are facing the park and the sky. Just two rooms are rather small, but I don't mind. And a very tiny kitchenette, but just very nice. And the toilet and bath, which are very nice. And they're all painted white and has a very pale gold fitted carpet. So that sounds really great. Tomorrow morning or something, maybe I should go and see it. And even if it's temporary, I can always give the lease to somebody, I suppose, because it sounds like a very cheap place for that, the location and all that.
What about?
No, thank you. No. The location and all that, it's less than £20 a week, meaning like £18 or something, as it comes to. Because it's 800 per annum. So, and central heating and all that. It sounds all very nice. But, and then I found out something else. That Andy Warhol and Mario Meyer were shot today in New York. I'm so glad that I wasn't there, because I would like to be there if I were in New York. Poor Mario. But the thing is, oh, and that's something that I should tell John. It's so funny. Mario used to, because he's a fag, I guess. I don't know what it is, but anyway, he was very, I think he's but your fag, as much as he could as a fag. I think he's terribly interested in me and all that. So what he does is he would just sort of like touch me on the neck or like my back or something like that, or sort of scratch my arm or something like that when I'm talking to somebody. And then he said, this girl is amazing, she doesn't even notice. You know, and made me feel like I'm a real frigid woman, which was true, because I really never noticed. And I was going to go, oh, you were scratching me or something. And it's just annoying, you know. But most of the time, I didn't even notice, because I was sort of deep in some conversation or something like that. And it made me used to wonder, my God, if I were sensitive at all, no matter what I was doing, if he would touch me or something, I should notice. You know, that used to bother me. But that's how I was, you see, it's amazing. Some will panic because I don't know what's going to happen tonight. Cindy's coming back, maybe. Are we going back to Weybridge or are we going to stay here? All that, you see. And that's what it is, I guess. I mean, it's my paranoia too. But that's something that's frightening me. That's something that we have to face together. See what it is, and like go through it together.
Thank you.
that this is my last chance, and that's it. I couldn't just aimlessly go. That game of avoiding reality and just making it in a more casual, simple way. I mean, that game is it's not a game, it's like a bad habit or something. If I ever want to really be happy. I wonder if all this makes sense to you.
Listen, I ain't one to take.
Don't worry.
Take your knickers off and let's go.
As you said.
Every bit of it.
Revolution take 20. Revolution take 20.
Pictures.
It is that.
It'll be all right. It'll be all right. It'll be all right.
Everything I chose so difficult because it's almost like being naked.
Number nine.
Space Dell.
Colonel.
We couldn't score this.
Number 9. Number 9.
Enabled him to move about all over the classroom.
Number 9, 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 number 9.
But the doctor has told him he had better get somewhere, like in the country, because his lungs were going for a burden. So the wife told him he'd better go to see a surgeon. Well, what the price it would be, right? He could no more afford a surgeon than he could a pair of yellow underclothes. So any road, he went to see the dentist instead of getting a pair of teeth, which wasn't any good at all. So instead of that, he joined the the Watusi, the twist,
Eldorado.
Take this, brother. May it serve you well.
Thank you.
We're back. So what we heard there was that personal tape of Yoko Ono recording notes about her life and herself, while in the background we hear the tape being played of Take 20, of Revolution, Take 20. And the Beatles are doing overdubs on it. And in that section, towards the end of it, of what we were listening to, the Beatles actually started vamping on another piece of music altogether. Even now, there's still significance to even that tape. Then I played, it came out around 2009. It appeared on the internet. 10 minutes, 45 seconds long. Revolution Take 20. It comes from an acetate, probably. That was June 4th, 1968. At the end of that day, that was what they had recorded. Now, in the previous day, they had worked up to 19 takes to get the rhythm track and everything right. So they're playing take 19, I guess, as take 20 while they do a series of overdubs. And this one, basically what you heard was the complete track with all overdubs, which was cut to two acetates. One went home with John. And since I'm playing these alternate versions of Revolution, I played Revolution 9 from an acetate again. And it was apparently mix one, remix one, mono mix one of Revolution 9. So it was the first time they did it. And they cut it to a two-sided aluminum disc. And that's what we heard, Revolution 9, from that aluminum disc. What I'm going to play are the two other variant versions of Revolution. I'll just play them back to back. One is the basic stereo track with vocals that the Beatles did in the studio, no overdubs. So it's just the Beatles doing the track. And this was before Nicky Hopkins did his fantastic piano overdub. And then I will play the version from the David Frost Show of around September 14th, 1968, in which the Beatles sing to the backing track and they do additional vocals that aren't on the record. So it's the same take for both versions that you're about to hear, but with different vocals. You know, this was the version of the song that was the single. All right.
self-destruction. Don't you know that you can count me out?
Don't you know I'm gonna be
alright? Alright. Alright. Say you got a real solution.
Beatles live on the David Frost Show, singing to a prepared tape. So, I guess what I've been doing is exploring the state of mind that creates something like all of that. Tonight on the Chill Room here on KillRadio.org, we've had some revelations about revolution. So thanks for listening and stay tuned.